This is podcast number 193 for the Well-Educated Mother's Heart. Hi, I'm Marlene Peterson, and today I want to share some more ideas about the art of living happily. The first book we reprinted in our Sunshine series was Understood Betsy by Dorothy Canfield, later Dorothy Canfield Fisher. I chose it because it captured the spirit of the well-educated heart. Last night I was digging through old books looking for stories for the next edition of My America Storybook, and I ran across a chapter on Dorothy Canfield. And when I read it, I knew I had to share it with you. You can't read about her without catching a spark of her enthusiasm for life, which she captured in the book Understood Betsy. In fact, she used her books to pass along the secrets she had learned for herself in the art of living happily. She reminded me of a gem I copied down from Martha Washington. I am still determined to be cheerful and happy in whatever situation I may be, for I have also learned from experience that the greater part of our happiness or misery depends upon our dispositions and not upon our circumstances. At the beginning of the chapter is this short verse from Matthew Arnold. Loveliness, magic, grace, they are here. They are set in the world, they abide, and the finest of souls hath not been thrilled by them all, nor the dullest been dead to them quite. If you are feeling a bit discouraged with events unfolding around us, this little light of Dorothy may be just what you need to clear away some of the gloom. The story comes from a book called High Adventurers by Mary Parkman, and I have a feeling we are going to see a lot of high adventure in the days ahead. Dorothy teaches us that difficulties may turn into opportunities if the challenge of everyday living is met in the spirit of high adventure. So, buckle up. Here's the chapter. She could never tell when she first made the discovery that each day gave chances for real adventure. There had always been a wonder and a thrill in everyday things. Swinging, for instance, when you felt the push of the whole earth against you as you kicked the ground vigorously enough to send you forward and back, faster and faster, until you could feel the joy of flying as you went forward, up almost into the heart of the tree itself. All sorts of things came to you with the rush of the wind in your face. It seemed as if you could feel the answers to some of the puzzling questions that you never could think out. Perhaps that was what the wonder of life meant. You could feel things inside yourself that you never could understand. What does it mean to be alive? How did you happen to be just Dorothy Canfield, a little girl swinging there in a friendly backyard and not somebody else? Did other people feel the same bubbling up wonder inside themselves that you did? There were always many questions that didn't seem to be answered. Why wasn't there an answer for every question? What is the sunshine? Well, it seemed that it was light and warmth sent from the sun that hurt your eyes when you tried to look at it and yet was farther away than you could think. It hurt when you tried to think about it. That was one of the things you could only feel, millions and millions of miles away and very much bigger than the world itself. Why can we see and feel sunshine but can't smell it or hear it? Why does sunshine go through the window of this room, but not through the wall? But the grown people did not pay much attention to the questions that came knocking at the door of a little girl's house of wonder. When I'm big enough to know the answers to children's questions, I'll surely take time to tell them the things they want to know, vowed Dorothy more than once. She did not forget this resolve, and years later often had much to say about the grown-ups who failed to satisfy the hunger of active minds. The worst part of it all is, she once said, that the children's faces looking up holding wonder like a cup turn away from us and our world as we do when we no longer look for anything interesting to happen. They lose their first belief that everything has meaning. The sense of wonder is starved out before it can lead them to the great adventure of living. What is the great adventure? A friend asked. The adventure of discovering that nothing is common and meaningless. The joy of finding that each day is a room with windows opening on a wide world of beckoning chances for happy work and play. Would we all have that fine start in life if somebody had tried hard enough to keep up with our never-ending questions? Somebody ventured.
The best start is certainly the one which gives us faith that it is worthwhile asking questions, was the prompt reply. I think the best thing in strengthening this faith is the learning to find the answers for ourselves. That is why it is more important for parents to provide a home with books, encyclopedias, dictionaries, and books that are guides to ways of doing and making things, than it is to invest in fine new furniture. The investments that bring real dividends are those that mean more living, thinking, and doing. Maybe the reason you seem to have time for so much worth doing is that you have never bothered about things the way so many of us have. The friend spoke as if she had just seen a ray of light that cleared up a particularly dark corner. It is quite true. I discovered early that life was more worthwhile than things, replied Dorothy Canfield. Perhaps I found this out through living and going to school in different places and learning to see with the eyes of different people, she suggested, as if thinking aloud. There was an English word and a French and an Italian word for the same thing, and what seemed important in one place had a way of shrinking out of sight in another. If we stay too much in one place, we are apt to think too much of that one spot and of ourselves. There is all the difference between spending your time in a room hung with mirrors and looking out from the top of a mountain. I admit it is seldom warm and cozy on the mountaintop, but the view is perhaps on the whole finer than anything in the looking glass. What were some of the places from which Dorothy Canfield learned to look about her and get something of the large view that sees life steadily and sees it whole? Part of her early years were spent in college towns where her father was a professor, first at the University of Kansas, later at the University of Nebraska, and Ohio State University. There was always plenty of active life and play to keep the alert young body and mind occupied. An Army officer serving on the staff of the War College near her Kansas home found the schoolgirl ready alike for lessons in horseback riding and a special introduction to the fascinations of mathematical problems that were, it seemed, the young man's pet hobby among indoor sports. Years afterward, at the time of the World War, the acquaintance was renewed in France. The friendly officer was now General Pershing. Some of Dorothy Canfield's early years were spent in France, where she played about in her mother's studio. While her mother made pictures, she made friends with French speech and French people. She was interested in words, as her mother was in color. Always we see what we are looking for, she used to say. In all her sojournings in France, my mother never took to the French tongue, so it was not from her that I got my love for languages. Perhaps this was one of the things about me that wasn't born, but, like Topsy, just growed. The love of languages certainly grew with her growth. When in college, she devoted special attention to French and Italian. The first book that she wrote was a study of the great French dramatists, Corneille and Racine. After her graduation from Ohio State University, it was her thoroughgoing study of the French masters that won for her the degree of Doctor of Philosophy from Columbia. During the years of study at Columbia, where her father was at that time the head librarian of the university, she was doing the work of secretary at the Horace Mann School. There she saw children at work and at play, remembered her own child ways, and thought about plans for making school days a better preparation for happy living. Variety is what life needs to keep us well-rounded, she used to say. We're all apt to get one-sided by going too much in one direction. Different experiences take off the corners that make life difficult. She was sure that many of the young, valuable things she had learned as a young girl had come to her not from books, but from people. It was during a year spent with a French family that she made a discovery that, for certain grown people, life was more than work and earning a living, and that they had live interests and pleasures such as music, reading, the theater, study, art, conversation, thinking, which could not be enjoyed or even understood by people who had not been trained in the right way. Money could not open the way to this good life. Only those might enter in who held the keys. I discovered in my school days in France, she said, that real study is tremendously worthwhile. I saw that the most stupid of all stupid things was to waste time, because with all possible haste and effort, one's childhood was scarcely long enough to learn how to handle the keys which opened the door of the world. She more than once found herself remembering certain dull, grown-up neighbors in the Kansas town where she had lived as a child. There seemed nothing for them to do but sit on their porch rockers on summer evenings, their eyes fixed on newspapers or on nothing at all. For them, life seemed to be all work. As for their children, it was all play. When the workday was over, it was as if they stopped living. The affairs of store, workshop, or office were all that they knew. Life for some of us is nothing more than a squirrel cage, she said. We keep running with all our might to turn the wheel of our petty little concerns of business or housekeeping, never stopping to think of what the free life outside the world may be like. Years later, she wrote the story of two young people whose lives became so cluttered with things that there was no chance for taking stock or moving freely from one day to another. There was no time to think or look about, no time for real living. She called the book The Squirrel Cage. Many people read the novel. This writer understands the problems of our American home life and helps us to understand some things we have never stopped to think about before, they said. 3 years later, she wrote The Bent Twig. As the twig is bent, so the tree is inclined, runs the proverb. In telling the story of Sylvia and Judith, daughters of a college professor, during their growing up days, she shows in this book the importance of childhood experiences in giving direction to one's whole life. That thought seemed to be always with her. She told the story later of another girl, eager for the adventure of living, who said, "My days must be full of interesting things, like a cup brimming over with the fullness of life." That book is called The Brimming Cup, and its story of beauty-loving, talented Maurice with her husband, Neil Crittenden, and their children in a Vermont village gives some vivid chapters of high adventure in everyday living. The characters in that book had become, as often happened, even more real to the author than the actual flesh-and-blood people that she knew. She found herself pondering about them and what they might be expected to do under different circumstances. All at once, the notion of a new sort of sequel presented itself to her imagination. It will be fine to tell the story of what happened to them before the time of the other book. I shall write, then, not a follow-up novel, but a sort of before-the-curtain account of their early years and how they happened to be the sort of young people that we discovered them to be in The Brimming Cup. The new book was called Rough Hewn, a title suggested by a passage from Shakespeare. There's a divinity that shapes our ends, rough hew them how we will. The way in which all the circumstances of early childhood and youth had their part in shaping the minds and characters of Maurice and Neil was the central idea of the narrative. All the little things that were soon forgotten, their first impressions of the world and the people about them, became powerful forces by which their natures were rough-hewn. The dim 6-year-old thoughts that are mostly feelings stir about at the roots of our lives, she said. The glory of a bed of tulips that suddenly fills the world with color, where just a few days before there was nothing but a few skimpy rolled-up leaves, becomes part of ourselves and of our sense of the wonder of life. No less we find ourselves trying to pick our way about in the maze of grown-up talk. We decide that conversation is talk that is intended to cover up what people are really thinking. We learn how to hide and dim and dull our natural wonder about the wide world of which we can glimpse only a tiny corner. We somehow conclude that everybody stops trying to understand what is hard to grasp and only learns how to use it. This seems to be common sense. It is common sense to shut off parts of life from other parts and live in bits and pieces of existence. So our ways of thinking and feeling are scrapped and scrambled, or we may say roughly shaped, rough-hewn, by the chances and changes of childhood impressions. In The Deepening Stream, there is an account of the great moments of play that make the chief zest of living for all healthy children. After supper, can I go out to play? Rose in every dining room. It was a mere formula. It meant, I'm going out to play unless I am stopped. And it was followed, in spite of occasional grasping but usually futile grown-up efforts to get some chores done by the children, by a running dive out of the kitchen or dining room door into enchantment. There were always children around who met like meeting drops of water. To the yelling and shouting of the game which they instantly started, flocked all the other children as soon as they were freed from sitting respectably at table to eat, from helping wash dishes or mind the baby, or from a spelling lesson to make up, encountering in the twilight a group of children madly scattering, a newcomer needed but to shout, "Who's it?" and "Where's the goal?" and he was ready to turn into race as madly as the others. They had more games to play than there was time for, because, like the gods on Olympus, they wearied not of familiar joys. When they had run through all the ones they knew, they started over again, with as sharp-toothed an appetite as though they had just begun. But they seldom needed to start over. There were great games that needed a dozen or 20 children, loud dramas like Run, Sheep, Run, or Prisoner's Base, and Red Rover, Come Over. In these, each child, shrinking and running with all his might, felt his single personal excitement magnified by the screams and agitations of his fellows beyond anything he could have achieved alone. In others, the excitement ran deep and silent, as in Mumble de Peg and Jackstones and Marbles, played by a silent group squatting or kneeling on the earth. There were in-between games like Duck on a Rock, in which moments of hovering suspense alternated rhythmically with explosions. For rainy days when play must be carried on undercover in barns or attics, there were eerie games of ghost-like silence, variations on Blind Man's Bluff. "Still pawn, no more moving, I give you 3 steps," screamed out the blindfolded it, all in one many-syllabled word. At the end of the formula, the other players, fleeing for their lives, halted in their tracks. A barn full of children scattered about, and not a sound. As far as the senses of the blindfolded player could tell him, the world was as empty as before creation. There were other books about these matters. One called Mothers and Children discussed seriously the vital importance of the first years of childhood, with its questioning, whims, fears, and fancies. Now is the chance to give the right start to the adventure of living, says the author. Another book was a book of plays, games, and pastimes for indoor and outdoor occasions, summer and winter holiday fun, and solitary occupations. This book of recreations was called What Shall I Do Next? All my life I have loved to play. Children grow and grown-ups let go in play, says Dorothy Canfield. Of course our play changes with the years. There is a time when we can be happy catching a bouncing ball, but later we need the glow that comes with team play, as in tennis and baseball. Play, like life itself, led on from one interesting thing to another. There was never a looking back with longing for vanished joys. Wouldn't you like to be one of those young folks when it comes to skating weather like this? She was asked once. No, why should I? I seem to enjoy skating even more than when I was so young that the most important thing as I whizzed over the ice was whether I was able to skate as well or better than the best. There was then always the need of proving myself. Now I can have the same enjoyment of the knife-edge poise and gliding speed together with a new delight in the tingling air and the beauties of the frosty trees. I don't envy that boy his speed and skill any more than a certain whimsical uncle of mine envied the cat that he allowed to have its nap out in his favorite chair. A cat has so few pleasures compared to those open to me, he said. There are many people who feel that Dorothy Canfield's books give them an insight into real living, an understanding of the people about them and of themselves. When Lord Grey, British Minister of Foreign Affairs, visited America at the time of the World War, he said to a group of Harvard students, "Since I have been in your country, I have read a book by an author new to me, Dorothy Canfield. I am sure that this book, The Bent Twig, is true and enduring literature, as it is a true and searching study of some of the most important chapters of our common experience. What are some of the more important chapters in Dorothy Canfield's own story that may explain her sympathy with different kinds of people and her zest for the adventures of everyday life? First in importance, perhaps, is her American heritage. The family came to America in 1636, and in 1764 were among the hardy, hill-loving people to take up land in the Green Mountain State. Like all Vermonters, she glories in the stories of Ethan Allen and his championship of the cause of the pioneers who had given their lives to make homes in the wilderness. When Dorothy Canfield was married in 1907 to John Redwood Fisher, they surprised their New York friends by going to live on the acres of mountain land that the bride had inherited from the Vermont Canfields. The young woman who had won honors at Ohio State University, in Paris at the Sorbonne, and also at Columbia University, took up the life of a homemaker in the country. There you may find her today if you climb a rather steep mountain road that winds up for about 2 miles from the little town of Arlington. The house to which wings have been added clings close to the ground, as firmly established as one of the neighboring boulders that is anchored to earth by the persistent growth of scrub pine and generations of wild grape and blackberry tendrils. Here Dorothy Canfield Fisher took root through a daily round of wholesome home tasks with indoors and without. The within tasks were those of a simple living that was free of concern for things as ends in themselves. All of the household gods had to prove their claim to respect as they served the ends of unfettered, happy living. The without claims included an active interest in the affairs of the town and of the world, no less than attention to the well-being of pine trees and an enterprising sawmill. There were, too, the joys of outdoor life, horseback riding, mountain climbing, tennis, and skating. When the young heroine of Understood Betsy is beginning to see her small problems in a setting of a much larger world than that of the farm and village, we watch her as she waxes her cup of maple syrup on a clean white snowbank under a pine tree. Elizabeth Ann took up her cup and poured some of the thick, hot syrup out on the hard snow, making loops and curves as she poured. It stiffened and hardened at once, and she lifted up a great coil of it, threw her head back, and let it drop into her mouth. Concentrated sweetness of summer days was in that mouthful, part of it still hot and aromatic, part of it icy and wet with melting snow. She crunched it all together with her strong child's teeth into a delicious big lump and sucked on it dreamily. Her eyes on the rim of Hemlock Mountain, high above her there, the snow on it brought golden in the sunlight. Uncle Henry had promised to take her to the top as soon as the snow went off. She wondered what the top of a mountain would be like. Uncle Henry had said the main thing was that you could see so much of the world at once. He said it was too queer the way your own house and big barn and great fields looked like little toy things that weren't of any account. It was because you could see so much more. The sun had gone down over Hemlock Mountain by this time, and the big slope above her was all in deep blue shadow. The mountain looked much higher now as the dusk began to fall and loomed up as though it reached to the sky. No wonder houses look small from its top. One idea, says Dorothy Canfield, is worth a million facts, because with the idea you can gather facts for yourself. We find in her books that rare power of bringing out into the open some of our vague, half-formed ideas and setting them to work for us. One of the ideas that she brings to the fore is the truth which Betsy glimpsed, that a large view of life makes us see things in proportion. Another idea is that which makes us realize that variety is not only the spice of life, but a safety valve. We need to know country life as well as city life, and people of different countries and different ways of looking at things. We need to learn through active life that we gain only as we give, that the brimming cup must be emptied before it can be filled again. In 1916, when her son Jimmy was 2 years old, Mrs. Fisher took him and her small daughter Sally with her to join her husband, who was serving as an ambulance driver in France. Some months later, when he was put in charge of a training camp for ambulance workers, Mrs. Fisher was made camp housekeeper. We may gather from her book, Home Fires in France, glimpses of her experiences. While connected with a home for blinded soldiers, she helped to organize an establishment for printing books that could be read by touch instead of sight, and for a year edited a magazine for blind French soldiers. When little Sally, who had been put in a French school, became ill with typhoid, the mother took her south to Biarritz, where she might grow well and strong again. Even then, she was helping in a Red Cross home for refugee children. At the end of the war, when, in 1919, she was once more back in the Vermont home, there was an uphill struggle for a time to regain normal health and strength. The book, Rough Hewn, was finished in Italy, where she went for some months of much-needed sunshine. But above all things, I love our Vermont winter, she said, when another year found her returning with restored vigor to the home acres. There are no joys quite equal to those of skating and snowshoeing when every breath means renewed life. She finds also opportunity for uninterrupted work when snowdrifts shut her away from the demands of the outside world. In addition to her novels and stories, Dorothy Canfield has written many works dealing with problems of education. She has also made a translation of Papini's Life of Christ from Italian into English. These labors, however, have not prevented her writing for the Vermont Parent Teachers Association, articles to be printed in the local papers, and a play for the Arlington Community Players in which she herself took the part of a lively old lady and even danced a jig for the cause. As a member of the Vermont State Board of Education, she has done active work for improving the schools of the country districts. When she inherited a large brick house in Arlington, she promptly turned it over to the town for use as a community house, reserving only one wing for lodging guests whom she and Vermont alike delight in honoring. The poet Robert Frost, another high adventurer in everyday living, is perhaps first among such sojourners in the little community. How is it that you manage to get so many things done? She is frequently challenged. I have a little way of thinking about some problem that is uppermost before I go to sleep, she once said whimsically. In the morning, somehow the tangled thread straightened out as if by magic. You may remember that Stevenson speaks somewhere of the way the little people of dreams bring things to pass as if by magic. I believe, too, in that white magic. Again, she said in all seriousness, when we begin to measure life by what we put into it, not by what it gives us, many things fall into place. The active life is really the free, happy life. The hankering for an easy time is like an old man of the sea. Once you let him persuade you to have him on your shoulders, you are lost, his slave, forced to go the way he wishes and not where you would like to go yourself. You cannot do this thing which all your higher self longs to do because you would be uncomfortable. Many people learn with surprise that Dorothy Canfield has worked with a handicap. Since the age of 14, she has been partially deaf, but ever on the alert to see the words of conversation that elude her dulled hearing. Have you a message for the deafened readers of our magazine? She was asked by a writer who was preparing a sketch of her life for a paper devoted to the interests of the deaf. Yes, tell them to learn lip reading, she replied, with characteristic common sense directness. But difficulties are challenges to new endeavor to this courageous woman. Face a problem fairly and then go out to meet it squarely. That is the way of life for Dorothy Canfield Fisher. Her days are invested in enterprises that bring returns in enduring satisfaction and the joy that comes to those who find that difficulties may turn into opportunities if the challenge of everyday living is met in the spirit of high adventure. Bye-bye. See you next time.